to 510-848-3812 or email us at calendar@kpfa.org. Attention to the community calendar. Tell us if your event is wheelchair accessible. To hear this calendar again, call 510-848-6767, extension 621. The calendar is also online at kpfa.org.
This is KPFA or KPFB Berkeley or KFCF in Fresno. Online, we're at kpfa.org. Stay tuned for Sunday Salon.
Good morning. It's April 8th, 2007. Welcome to KPFA Radio's Sunday Salon. I'm your host, Sandra Lupien, honored to be sitting in for Larry Bensky today. Larry will be back next week. On Friday, the United Nations Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change released a report by more than 2,500 of the world's scientists. It warned of increasing desertification and drought, with billions at risk of flooding, with mostly poor countries and poorer people within rich countries hardest hit. It predicted rising ocean levels tied to glacial melting, rising temperatures, heat waves, and the disappearance of the Great Barrier Reef. It was the most dire IPCC warning to date. The reality of global warming is starting to sink in, and fewer people are questioning whether human activities, especially driving, are largely to blame. On today's program, we'll spend both hours talking about possible solutions. In the first hour, a discussion on biofuels. Are corn, palm oil, grasses, and cow dung the green solution to reducing the world's dependence on fossil fuels, especially oil? Or do they produce insufficient energy, threaten the food supply, the environment, and human rights? And then in the second hour, next Saturday, thousands of people across the country will take part in more than 1,300 rallies. It's part of a National Day of Climate Action. We'll talk with an organizer from the Step It Up 2007 campaign, plus folks in New Orleans and Berkeley who are planning actions. We'll have dialogue, debate, theater, and music today. Stay tuned. As the science on global warming gets more and more difficult to question and the predictions about its deleterious effects grow more dire and imminent, people are looking for ways to turn down the heat. Scientists say carbon emissions are a chief contributor to the Earth's warming. Most human-made carbon emissions come from burning fossil fuels in transportation vehicles as well as industry. The United States is the biggest emitter of carbon in the world. In his January 23rd State of the Union address, President George W. Bush called for 35 billion gallons of renewable fuels per year within 10 years. That's enough to replace 15% of gasoline burned in American cars and trucks. Congress is considering measures that would require 60 billion gallons by 2030, and the U.S. is not alone in its focus on biofuels. This hour on Sunday Salon, a discussion about biofuels. Are they green? Do they reduce dependence on foreign oil? What do they mean for farmers in the U.S. and elsewhere? I'm Sandra Lupien, sitting in for Larry Bensky today, and I am encouraging those of you who are listening to participate in this segment by email. You can email me at sundaysalon@kpfa.org, and later this hour we'll take your phone calls. I'm joined for the hour by three guests. Jake Caldwell is a director of policy for the Energy Opportunity Program in the National Security Department at the Center for American Progress. He's the author of a report titled Navigating the 2007 Farm Bill, Biofuels and the WTO Doha Round. Jake Caldwell, thanks for being with us this morning.
Good to be here.
Isabella Kenfield is a freelance journalist based in Brazil. She's a contributor to the International Relations Center's Americas program. She's written about how ethanol production in Brazil affects that nation's economy, land, and its landless workers. Isabella Kenfield, pleasure to have you here this morning.
Thank you for having me.
And Tom Philpott farms and cooks at Maverick Farms in Valley Cruces, North Carolina. Maverick's a 2.5-acre mixed vegetable farm with a 25-family CSA program. He's also staff writer at grist.org, a Seattle-based online environmental magazine. And in December, Tom Philpott edited a special series on biofuels for Grist. Tom, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Sandra.
And I've asked each of our guests this morning to prepare a brief opening statement laying out their positions on the global push toward biofuels. And I'm going to ask each of you to present those statements now. And Jake Caldwell, I'd like to start with you.
Sure. At the Center for American Progress, we've been sort of taking a look at the whole issue of biofuels from a broad perspective in terms of how do biofuels fit into our agriculture policy, our trade policies, and our energy policy in the United States, and how biofuels fit into a world in which we're seeing, as you mentioned, you know, the IPCC report on climate change, where climate change is real, the evidence is in, we have a need to reduce our greenhouse gas emissions. At the same time, our global energy demand is up and rising. Global dependence on fossil fuels is also rising. And we have our trade negotiations stuck in the mud primarily because of our agriculture policies in the European Union and the U.S. So we take a look at all those issues, roll them into one ball, and we come out with a look at in the short term of biofuels as being a sensible approach to potentially meeting our liquid fuel needs and energy demands. Having said that, we don't think that biofuels themselves are a silver bullet solution to all of our energy demands. We're going to have to improve our fuel economy. We're going to have to produce these biofuels sustainably. And we're going to have to move rapidly to a next generation of advanced biofuels beyond corn to cellulosic biofuels. But the potential is there for biofuels to really help us to reduce our dependence on fossil fuels, reduce our greenhouse gas emissions, and diversify. And that's the key word, diversify our sources of energy.
Jake Caldwell with the Center for American Progress. Thanks for those remarks. We'll go now to farmer Tom Philpott in North Carolina. Where do you stand on biofuels?
Well, I think, first of all, it's important to note that for at least the next 10 years, when we talk about biofuel in the United States, we're pretty much talking about corn. And if we're going to meet President Bush's goal of 35 billion gallons within the next 10 years, we're going to be doing it with corn because cellulosic technologies are still a ways off. People have been saying for 10 or 15 years now that they're 5 years off, and I just read in the current Foreign Affairs an article by Seaford Runge, who's been a pretty big biofuel booster in the past, saying that we shouldn't expect contributions from cellulosic for 10 years. Given that, I think it's important for us to really look at the impacts of corn-based ethanol and their real energy returns, et cetera. And I think that if you look at the level of support that corn-based ethanol is getting now, by some estimates, it's the total support, including at all government levels, is about $6 billion. And estimates say, I've also seen estimates that say that if we're going to make President Bush's goal come true, it'll take about $11 billion in public money. And I want to just compare that real quick to the Amtrak budget. In President Bush's latest budget proposal, he proposes cutting the budget to Amtrak by about 30%, down to about $900 million. And so in his dream world, or you know, the world that he's moving us toward, we're going to spend $11 on corn ethanol for every dollar we spend on trains. And I think that's a little bit crazy.
Tom Philpott, thanks for those remarks. Isabella Kenfield, you're based in Brazil, where there is a growing ethanol industry, mostly based on sugarcane. And your remarks relate specifically to ethanol in Brazil.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm ready for your statements.
Okay. As the largest exporter of ethanol in the world, Brazil faces an important decision in how it will respond to the growing demand for ethanol by wealthier, more powerful countries in the global north, especially the U.S. Politically, Lula has two choices. First, he can promote the development of an export-based ethanol industry that fuels the consumption patterns in the north. This will ultimately repeat the model of development via agro-export historically adopted by and imposed on the country. Agro-export, especially of sugarcane, of which Brazilian ethanol is made, has always resulted in the concentration of land and wealth in the hands of a few, and poverty, exclusion, and exploitation for many. As Brazil develops an export-based ethanol industry, an alliance between Brazilian agro-capital and international agro- and petro-capital will be consolidated, and control over the country's land and ethanol industry will reside solely in the hands of a few multinational agribusinesses. Alternatively, Lula can choose to develop an ethanol industry focused on supplying Brazil's large internal market in conjunction with an agrarian policy that prioritizes food production for Brazilians. In this alternative scenario, production and control of the industry would be in the hands of small farmers, made possible through the implementation of a comprehensive agrarian reform. Also, the way in which Brazil develops in the ethanol industry will greatly influence the momentum of the leftward political swing in Latin America. Unfortunately, it appears that Lula is opting to develop an export-based ethanol industry.
Isabella Kenfield, thank you so much. She's a freelance journalist based in Brazil and has written about how ethanol production in Brazil affects the nation's economy, land, and its landless workers. You're tuned to KPFA Radio's Sunday Salon. The topic this hour is biofuels. Are they the answer to climate change, to foreign oil dependence, or do they come with their own set of problems that makes them a questionable solution at best? Our other guests are Jake Caldwell with the Center for American Progress and Tom Philpott, writer with Grist.org and a farmer in North Carolina. According to a paper published by the Oakland-based food policy watchdog Food First, 99% of biofuels produced in the United States are made from corn and soy, and the production of corn-based ethanol has tripled from 2001 to 2006. A February 15th National Public Radio report said corn-based ethanol is, quote, presently the only commercially viable means of ethanol fuel production. Tom Philpott, that's in line with something you said in your opening statements, and critics say corn must be heavily fertilized to grow at a large scale and that this has a negative impact on the environment. Could enough corn be grown organically or using few pesticides to meet the nation's energy needs, Tom Philpott?
That's a really interesting question about organic. And I don't think, first of all, I don't think that is on the table at all. I don't think anybody's seriously talking about organic corn production on a mass scale for ethanol. And one thing that that's really important to think about is that corn is our biggest crop in the United States. The United States produces 40% of the world's corn. And if we were to take the entire corn crop, I'm talking about conventional corn here, and convert it into ethanol, we would offset about 12% of total gasoline consumption in the United States. And that's a pretty staggering fact, because if we were to put all that land, all those millions of acres into our gas tanks, then that would be taking out a huge chunk of our agricultural base for food production, and food prices would go through the roof. And clearly nobody's really thinking about that. But we are talking about putting about half of our corn production into ethanol, and that is going to have, and it's already having, just in tripling from 2001 to 2006, we've already seen a dramatic rise in the price of corn, and that's had a knock-on effect in a lot of different places like Mexico with tortilla prices. But to get back to your question about organic production, I don't think that organic production of corn can make enough of a dent to really make a difference. It would be a lot better. It would address a lot of the problems of fertilizer runoff and fertilizer evaporating into the environment and causing greenhouse gases. But I don't think that it's a viable option.
And you've mentioned fertilizer and increased greenhouse gas emissions from growing corn in a, quote, conventional way as opposed to an organic way. What are some of the other possible environmental effects of this type of production?
Well, the thing about corn production is that it's by far our most thirsty crop in terms of fertilizer. It takes a lot of fertilizer to grow corn. And corn, right now, we're putting three times more fertilizer on corn than we are on any other crop by far. And we're increasing corn production. Currently we're 2007, we're planting our biggest corn harvest ever. We've boosted corn planting by about 15%. And so that means a whole bunch of artificial fertilizer going into the atmosphere. And the thing about corn production is that when you grow corn, you have to sort of over-fertilize to make sure every plant gets enough fertilizer. And so you end up with a lot of excess fertilizer in the ground, and it doesn't just sit there. One of two things happens to it. Either it evaporates and goes into the air in the form of a greenhouse gas called nitrous oxide, which is more than 300 times more potent a greenhouse gas than carbon dioxide. Or it runs into streams which run into the Mississippi, and basically the whole Midwest, its streams run into the Mississippi, and this causes algae blooms all through the Mississippi down to the Gulf of Mexico. And as a lot of your listeners will know, every year a giant algae bloom about the size of New Jersey opens up in the Gulf of Mexico, and it basically blots out marine life under it, and it ruins economies along the Gulf of Mexico that have for a long time made their living off of shrimping and other kinds of fishing. So the environmental impacts of the idea that that corn-based ethanol is somehow green or somehow a green bridge solution to our energy problem is really kind of puzzling to me. I mean, I just don't see it.
And with that in mind, Jake Caldwell, I want to talk about the fact that, you know, you advocate for different types of biofuels, but it's pretty clear that in the interim, corn's going to be the way if we're going to be producing any sort of biofuels in this country. Studies show corn ethanol is having varying degrees of net energy production, meaning how much energy a unit generates versus how much it takes to produce that energy unit. And one widely cited study by David Pimentel at Cornell University says it takes about 30% more energy to produce a gallon of ethanol, and I think that's corn-based ethanol, than you actually get out in the ethanol itself. Your response?
Definitely the energy balance question of corn ethanol has been in the news for quite some time. There's been a lot of back and forth on it, but it has generally, in contrast to the Pimentel study, generally been settled in favor of corn almost to the other extreme, almost 30% positive energy balance. And I would refer you to the journal Science from last year, in October, to look at some studies out of UC Berkeley and elsewhere in terms of the energy balance question. But I just do want to address, I mean, it also is a legitimate question that we should always keep in the forefront of our mind in terms of the fossil fuels being used to produce corn, the nitrogen fertilizer that's being placed on the ground. I mean, those issues all should be taken into account, but at this given time, corn does still seem to come out ahead. I do want to emphasize and just pick up on Tom's points in terms of corn. The USDA, U.S. Department of Agriculture, is estimating that we're going to be planting more corn this year than at any time since 1944. That definitely does impact in terms of our water use, our land use, and some of the nitrogen fertilizers that's been going onto the crop. But most studies indicate that corn-based ethanol does have a 13% reduction in our greenhouse gas emissions. Some of the silver linings of corn-based ethanol will involve less dumping of our commodities on the world market, which should raise the price of corn globally, and that should help low-income farmers overseas. It's currently helping U.S. farmers in terms of the price of corn going up to approximately $3.50 a bushel. It's been mostly at $2 a bushel for several years. So these kind of impacts are good things. But there's no question that if we're going to rely on corn-based ethanol, we need to couple that with greater fuel efficiency standards for our cars. We need to make sure that the ethanol we're producing actually has greenhouse gas reduction impacts, and we need to make sure that there are standards there for land and water resource use.
Jake Caldwell with the Center for American Progress, in your recent report on this topic, you talk a lot about the subsidies that the government, the federal and state governments in the United States, are offering to farmers who grow corn for fuel, and that amounts to about $3 billion annually. Can you talk a little bit about these subsidies and what you think might be better solutions?
Well, there's a couple things. In terms of subsidies for ethanol, actually most of the subsidy goes to the blender. It doesn't go to the farmer. So the farmer is shut out from the subsidy, and right now we provide a 51 cent per gallon subsidy to the blenders of ethanol. We feel like that subsidy should be taken a good hard look at in terms of potentially making it a little bit more real world and scaling it to the price of oil. So if the price of oil is up, the subsidy should come down, and vice versa. In addition, and this goes to Isabella's points on Brazil and the global market in biofuels, we also have a 54-cent import tariff on biofuels in this country. We think that it's time to take a good look at that as well and begin to phase that down so that we can encourage a global market in biofuels so that those developing countries that have an interest in a niche market in producing biofuels can get their production off the ground and potentially service the U.S. market. If we're going to come anywhere close to meeting the president's goal of 36 billion gallons, we're going to need to develop a global biofuels market. And that presents opportunities not only for developing countries, but it also presents opportunities for U.S. farmers and U.S. innovators in terms of technology that we can share around the world.
And U.S. farmers are a topic I'd like to come back to in a few minutes, but Jake Caldwell, your remark brings me to the issue of tariffs on foreign produced ethanol. And as you mentioned, Brazil has a major ethanol industry based in mostly sugarcane. Isabella Kenfield, can you talk about the implications of President Bush's recent visit to Brazil in terms of ethanol production and trade? You're on the ground there, and you've surely heard a lot about this.
Well, it's definitely been in the news a lot and talked about a lot, and there's people who are really excited about the prospects of the economic growth that will be generated by ethanol, especially from Brazil's sales to the U.S. And then there's a lot of people that are really worried about the social and environmental costs that this is going to have for Brazil. Interestingly, in response to Mr. Caldwell's discussion about the 54-cent tariff, when Bush was on his way, there was a statement, João Pedro Stedley, the head of the landless rural workers movement here in Brazil, made a statement saying, I hope that Bush refuses to lower the 54% tariff, because from his perspective and from the perspective of the MST and other social movements, the rural poor, lowering the 54% tariff is just going to encourage development of an export-based ethanol industry that's not going to benefit the Brazilian countryside or the people in the Brazilian countryside. So it's just interesting. Mr. Caldwell talks about this sort of development of a global ethanol market, but essentially it would be the development of a global ethanol market that would be created to supply consumption in the global north, especially the U.S. I mean, I think we have to acknowledge the fact that I read Mr. Caldwell's paper today, and it seemed that he was sort of proposing that this development of this global ethanol market is going to help stimulate rural economies and rural agricultural systems to start producing for export. And I just don't agree that that's going to help the people in the Brazilian countryside.
Isabella Kenfield, let's talk a little bit about what specifically such a program would mean for people in the Brazilian countryside, Brazilian landless workers and other types of farmers there. There's monocropping involved in this type of production, planting one type of crop on a large scale. There's a need for more land in order to support the quantities that are being called for. How does that look for folks on the ground in Brazil?
Well, sugar has been cultivated and produced here for export essentially since Portuguese colonization. Brazil currently has one of the widest gaps of income distribution and one of the most unequal land distributions in the world. Sugarcane has definitely contributed to this development. As Brazil develops an export-based ethanol industry, there's no doubt that more and more land is going to be planted to the monoculture of sugarcane. So it's just going to exacerbate the same problems that have been existing in Brazil for 500 years.
And other poorer nations in the world are also looking at ways to produce ethanol. One way is using palm oil and planting palm crops. That's happening in Colombia and in Singapore. And so this is not something that's really isolated. Other economies, other countries are looking at this. And I think that Isabella Kenfield, you might want to comment on that.
To be honest, I don't really have much experience with these other countries' experiences with palm oil. My work is really focused on Brazil right now. I could talk a little bit about the proposal that other crops like eucalyptus and fast-growing trees for other types of biofuels. I know that that's one proposal on the table. Mm-hmm. And I also think that that's not an answer. The monoculture of eucalyptus is spreading at an unprecedented rate throughout the southern cone, and it wreaks environmental and social havoc. It spreads what people refer to as a green desert.
And we'll be coming back to the issue of other possible types of biofuels a little bit later in this segment. I want to turn back now to farmer Tom Philpott, writer for grist.org, and look at how the current model of subsidizing corn for ethanol fuel affects farmers here in the United States. Tom Philpott, can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, well, first of all, to go back to something that Jake said a second ago, actually, corn farmers traditionally have gotten huge subsidies. They're not getting so many subsidies. They probably won't get too many subsidies in 2007 because, as Jake said, the price of corn has shot up. And it's, I believe it's now over $4 a bushel on futures markets, and that's up from a low of about $1.50 a bushel a couple years ago. And when it was down to at the $1.50, $2 range, that the subsidies were huge. I believe it's true to say that corn farmers were getting about between $3 and $5 billion a year. And even, you know, if a quarter of that, or you know, a fifth of that corn was going to ethanol production, that's a de facto subsidy to ethanol producers, because the way that the subsidy system generally works is that it's basically it's concentrated on four or five commodity crops that are corn, soy. Jake can probably help me out here. Corn, soy, cotton, wheat. I think peanuts are up there, and a few other things, but it's very, very tightly concentrated on just a few commodities. And what it encourages in the Midwest and other parts of the country is for farmers to grow as much as they possibly can, because the way the subsidy works is that the government steps in and pays the difference between the production cost and the market cost. And I think the USDA figures that it costs farmers about $2.50 a bushel to produce corn. And that's gone up with, and that it may have gone up since that number, since I learned that number, but it goes up because of the cost of fertilizer has been going up, because fertilizer is based on natural gas, and natural gas prices have been going through the roof. And corn production also takes a lot of oil, a lot of petroleum, because farmers use combines to harvest it. So when the market price of corn is $1.50, and the government, so the government will pay farmers $1 a bushel to make up for that that dollar gap. And what that does is it encourages farmers to keep planting corn, even though the market is telling them that there's way too much corn out there. Because if the market price is $1 less than the cost of production, that means that you're producing way too much. And so the subsidy system has worked to keep farmers producing commodities at incredibly high levels, even when there wasn't enough of a market for them. And who does that situation benefit? It doesn't really benefit the farmers, because mostly, you know, even large-scale farmers generally don't make very much money, and a lot of them actually lose money. Who it benefits is the companies who buy the commodities. And the companies that buy the commodities are a very few grain trading firms, including Archer Daniels Midland and Cargill and a few others. And these are also the firms that basically dominate biofuel production in the United States. And so basically the subsidy system, the way it is only concentrated on farmers who farm a few commodities, and really the benefits of it accrue to big corporations like Archer Daniels Midland, which it allows to buy huge amounts of stuff like corn and soy at cut rate prices, which they then turn into industrial food products and ethanol, et cetera, et cetera. And I think a lot of our, I think that a lot of people know that that we're in the United States facing a healthcare crisis because of rising obesity rates and rising diabetes rates, and a lot of it can be tied directly to the availability of this incredibly cheap supply of low quality food that companies like Archer Daniels Midland are turning into food products that end up in, basically they sell the feed that goes into the feedlots that feed our cows. They sell the, create the high fructose corn syrup that goes into our sodas, et cetera, et cetera. All these sort of low-quality food products that make our food system the cheapest in the world as a percentage of available income, but also make it probably one of the world's most unhealthy food supplies. So the subsidies are pushing and directing farmers to growing not really food for people to eat, but actually industrial inputs that companies then turn into food for people to eat. And a small operation like mine, Maverick Farms over in North Carolina, vegetable farmers get essentially zero subsidies. We're producing something that somebody can, we're producing a tomato or some salad greens that somebody can actually eat. And the economics are extremely difficult, and I can talk about that a little bit later. But I think it's pretty tragic that under the current farm bill, which is about to phase out, that there's been over the last 5 years something like $20 billion a year going into propping up this large-scale industrial vegetable production, or not vegetable, but large-scale industrial grain and corn production that's ruining people's health, and there's been virtually zero money reinvesting in local food infrastructure, which is where I think the Farm Bill should be going.
And we're going to talk a little bit more about the Farm Bill in just a few minutes. That's the voice of Tom Philpott. He's a farmer and a cook at Maverick Farms in Valle Cruces, North Carolina. Also on the line is Brazil-based American journalist Isabella Kenfield, who has written much on ethanol industry in Brazil, how it affects the land and the workers there, as well as Jake Caldwell, a director of policy for the Energy Opportunity Program in the National Security Department at the Center for American Progress. You're tuned to Sunday Salon on KPFA and KPFB in Berkeley, KFCF in Fresno, online at kpfa.org. The show is Sunday Salon. I'm Sandra Lupien, sitting in for Larry Bensky. The topic this hour is the global push for biofuels. And I want to open up our phone lines now to make our guests and this debate available to our listeners. And if you're interested in making a comment or asking a question, please call 1-800-958-9008. That's our toll-free number. Our local number is 510-848-4425. They both go to the same place, so it's equal opportunity. And just want to ask folks who do call to keep your comments concise and brief. I know there's going to be a lot of people wanting to weigh in on this issue, and there's a lot to say. Right now, I want to move back to the Farm Bill, which Tom Philpott just mentioned. Congress is set to pass a new version of the Farm Bill this year, which will expire. The Farm Bill provides support and subsidies for agriculture in the United States. Jake Caldwell, in your report, Navigating the 2007 Farm Bill Biofuels in the WTO Doha Round, you lay out a plan for what you think needs to be included in the Farm Bill in order to foster the development and promotion of various types of biofuels in this country. Explain your recommendations briefly. I know there's a lot.
Right. Well, I just want to, in terms of, for those who don't know, 2007, Congress here in Washington, D.C. is starting to look at reauthorizing the Farm Bill. As Tom pointed out, a big chunk of the Farm Bill in 2002, we've seen $20 billion, that's with B with a billion with a B, in funding for commodity subsidies for these five major crops in the last year alone. Now, those subsidies will be well down as the price of these commodities has come up, and that's good news. That's good news for the individual farmer, and it's good news for the taxpayer in terms of less subsidies. One of the key recommendations in the report, Fueling the New Farm Economy, and it's available at AmericanProgress.org, is to, instead of paying forward to some very few and very large, tend to be very large commodity producers, these large subsidies, we should be encouraging environmental stewardship on our lands and what we term green payments to farmers for the proper care of their lands. And that should include land and water resource management use, but it should also include the growing of dedicated energy crops towards biofuels as a potential future area that will be a lot less impactful on the taxpayers' budget, but also will do a lot for rural America and rural communities. The other thing, just very briefly, that we recommend in the report are indeed moving beyond corn for biofuels, making sure that this whole biofuels industry is locally focused in terms of farmer cooperatives and locally owned biorefineries and plants. It's a little known fact that right now over half the ethanol plants in the United States are farmer owned, but that could be rapidly changing as a lot of money comes in from Wall Street, a lot of investor absentee sort of landlord money comes into the industry, and that's something that needs to be monitored, and it's something that the Farm Bill could possibly do to make sure that the ethanol industry stays in local hands and local communities. And we want to make sure that the biofuel production is sustainable as well, in terms of it's our use of land resources and conserving water, making sure that we maximize our carbon dioxide reduction. So those are just a few of the recommendations, Sandra.
Thanks, Jake Caldwell. Tom Philpott is a farmer. How do you respond to Jake Caldwell's recommendations for the Farm Bill?
I am theoretically in favor of the idea of green payments, but I would like to step back and look at the food system as a whole and just talk a little bit about the way that over the last 40 or 50 years, as the food industry has consolidated, and as probably a lot of your listeners know, you know, four or five pork packers control something like 70% of pork production in the United States, and it's the same with beef and chicken. And in terms of vegetables, most regional markets are very concentrated in the hands of a few grocery store chains, and it differs market to market, but usually three or four, with Walmart playing the role of number one or number two in most markets. And overall, it's the biggest grocery in the United States. With that situation, that means that vegetable buying power is very much concentrated in the hands of a few corporations. A few corporations in each region, and that gives incredible pricing power, incredible price control over prices to the big buyers, not to the farmers. And what that situation has done is created. Created a situation in which there's very little local food infrastructure around the country. And what I mean by that is that the local areas have very few dairy processing plants, very few USDA-approved meat processing plants. In my area, there are probably four or five organic farms in the two-county region that I operate in that are growing food for local production. And there's virtually no infrastructure for them. There's no central washing facility. There's no truck that we own collectively to get our stuff around. And all of this makes local food production extremely expensive. There used to be in one little town in my county, there used to be 10 small-scale dairy farms that thrived 20 years ago. Now, as the milk processing industry is consolidated, and one company called PET has taken a huge control over it, the milk processing infrastructure has collapsed. It's moved farther and farther away from the farmers. They have to pay to get their milk shipped there. And so the dairy industry in my area has completely ended. And so what I would like to see think tanks like the Center for American Progress looking at is how can we reinvest in local food infrastructure to make local food production more vibrant, more economically viable. And what the challenge that I see is this: farmers doing what I'm doing and growing food for the local markets aren't making enough money to make those investments. And I believe that we need public investment. I think the public has to decide as a whole if it wants local food production. And if it does, we're going to have to invest in it. Now, that sounds like socialism, but as Jake just said, we're spending $20 billion a year propping up commodity production, the beneficiaries of which are generally these three or four grain trading corporations. So I would like to see a farm bill that addresses the question of how do we rebuild local food infrastructure. If there's $20 billion sitting on the table, can some of that money not go to what I'm talking about? And I put that question to Jake.
Jake Caldwell, your response.
Well, I absolutely agree. I mean, under the current farm bill, the mostly what we call the specialty crops in this country, the fruit and vegetable growers don't get a dime of any of the food support or the income support from federal legislation. Now, that needs to change, and I think one of my expertise is not in sort of the food infrastructure system, but I think it's quite clear that there ought to be creative things that we can do in terms of helping folks like Tom to increase the research and development in this area for organic, for food and veggies and fresh fruits. And we can also make capital available. If the problem is a lack of capital in competing against large sort of mono industries, there ought to be ways that we can provide tax incentives and loan guarantees that would allow that the federal government can sort of incubate and help the smaller producer to compete in an increasingly globalized fruit and vegetable market.
I think now's an important time to note that corn for fuel production's driven up the prices for corn, and that's not sitting well with farmers who feed corn to their livestock, and it's also not sitting well with people in Mexico, where the price of tortillas, a staple food item, has skyrocketed. Tom Philpott, you mentioned that earlier. Corn is a key ingredient in most processed foods, which are maybe not the healthiest, but experts have predicted a rise in prices at the supermarket. Lester Brown, who's of Earth Policy Institute, warns that a biofuel boom could create, quote, epic competition between 800 million people with automobiles and the 2 billion poorest people. So, Tom Philpott, tell me, will the push for biofuels create a global food shortage, at least in the poorest nations?
Well, I don't know if it'll create a shortage, but it'll certainly cause prices to jump. And, basically the thrust of economic development over the past 50 or maybe even 100 years has been in places like Brazil and places in the global south, has been to, you know, to basically get people off of the land and into cities. And I don't know much about Brazil, but I did live for a couple of years in Mexico and worked down there as a reporter. And basically in Mexico in the 1980s, there was an explicit idea in the government, which is at the time led by Carlos Salinas, that there were too many peasants in the countryside and not enough people in the cities to work in factories. And the government basically began to dismantle its old the old smallholder agriculturalist tradition, and it unleashed, basically it evicted millions and millions of people off of their land. And that trend continues today, and it intensified with NAFTA. And so basically what you're getting in Mexico and throughout the global south are these mega cities full of people that the jobs that were promised them never completely materialized. So you got a lot of underemployed, impoverished people in mega cities who have little or no access to land to grow their own food. And now what you're doing is by jacking up the price of, and basically in the United States, food is so cheap and corn products are so cheap that we're not going to see for a little while probably much of a difference in the price of something like cornflakes. Now, meat's going to be different. Meat's going to go up faster because the biggest input to meat production is corn and other grains and soybeans, and all that stuff is going up. But in the global south, in a place like Mexico City, if you're a poor person in Mexico City and your food costs rise by 3%. Your income is not rising by 3%, and maybe you're already on the margin, and you're gonna see people at risk of food insecurity go into starvation mode, and you're gonna see hunger and starvation exacerbating in places like that, and there are people that say that the U.S. food system is too cheap, and if we make corn more expensive, maybe that would inspire farmers to use more pasture-based methods of growing and things like that. But I think that we've got to look at urban poor populations, and we can't just divert a bunch of corn to ethanol and say that it's going to be fine because food's too cheap anyway, when there are all these people throughout the global south that are reliant on, lots of cheap food production. And I think Lester Brown, I think his point is brilliant, that, basically we're pitting this elite group of car owners against a very non-elite group of people who don't own cars, and you know who's going to win that one. So I think these are things that we really have to think about.
And that's the voice of Tom Philpott, farmer from North Carolina. He's joining us on Sunday Salon today to talk about biofuels, along with Jake Caldwell from the Center for American Progress and Isabella Kenfield, Brazil-based journalist who writes about the effect of the ethanol industry on workers and the land in Brazil. We have a bunch of people waiting on the telephone, listeners who want to weigh in on this issue, and I'd like to start with Marla in Montebello. Marla, thanks so much for joining us this morning on Sunday Salon.
What an interesting topic, and I really thought I heard a little glimpse of something about subsidizing Amtrak, and I like that idea. That's a good way to transport people. But I heard on another program on KPFK, which I listened to down here, about that there is a crop that is extremely easy to grow and very non-polluting, etc., and very renewable, and that's hemp. It would take a whole legalization of the hemp product, not the marijuana, but the hemp, to make a really good product that could be grown to produce biofuel without taking away the food from people and subsidizing the big corporations. And I'm wondering if your guests know anything about that.
Yeah, let's check in about that, Marla. You're not alone in your interest in that. Several people have sent emails about hemp. Jake Caldwell, what do you know about hemp as a biofuel?
I don't know that much, unfortunately, but I think it raises an interesting point. I mean, on the food versus fuel debate, as this is often termed, I think, and Lester Brown is pointing to, and with good reason, I mean, I think we need to acknowledge that there are going to be impacts as the more that we interact with combining sort of energy and our food markets, there is definitely the potential, as Tom notes, for our food and vegetable prices and vegetable oil prices to rise. And that's all the more reason why it's important to make sure that, and particularly in developing countries, there are safeguards associated with moving to sort of commercial-scale biofuel production. I mean, that includes making sure that local populations are involved in all the decision-making that goes on around biofuel production. That makes it important to make sure that there's protection against instability in sort of food price markets. And we need to address some of the environmental issues in terms of the potential creep of biofuel production onto environmentally sensitive areas. What the hemp question raises, though, is the potential for getting biofuels out of sort of non-food crops. And I think this is an area that deserves a lot more attention. I'm not sure of the growing cycle of hemp, but certainly a lot of the famous switchgrass and miscanthus, that the president mentioned in his State of the Union 2 years ago, particular switchgrass, it can be harvested several times a year. It can be grown on marginal land. It's an indigenous prairie grass. It doesn't necessarily compete with food on the table. The other example is Jatropha, a oil-producing plant that is being grown in India on marginal land. So I think the hemp issue raises the question that shouldn't we be moving, if we're going to be serious about biofuels, we should be moving quite rapidly towards non-food crops grow for biofuels.
And another listener, or at least one, has emailed during this hour and said something along the lines of, it's right here in front of me. It's Barbara in San Francisco. She says, when are we going to get real and start talking about conservation? Many cars in Europe get around 43 miles per gallon, and there are few SUVs on the road there. Imagine if a progressive government retooled its war industry to develop energy conservation products like mass transit and solar energy products. Now, Tom Philpott, what are your thoughts on that?
I think that the listener in San Francisco is exactly right. I mean, I think that one thing that Jake mentioned that on balance, some studies show that corn-based ethanol reduces greenhouse gas emissions by about 13%. But my big question to that is, at what cost? If it's costing us if it's costing us $6 billion a year to prop it up, and right now I think that it's offsetting something like 4% of gasoline production, is taking that 4% and reducing our greenhouse gas emissions by 13% worth $6 billion a year? I've read studies that show that basically, corn ethanol is 200 times more expensive, a 200 times more expensive method of reducing greenhouse gas emissions than other methods like simple conservation. And I think that before we start building out all this incredible infrastructure and putting all this energy into it, I think there's a lot of really low-tech things that we can do, like simple conservation, like significantly boosting CAFE standards. And, I would venture to bet that boosting CAFE standards significantly to European levels or Japanese levels would be cheaper than this corn ethanol production. And just to get back real quick to cellulosic ethanol and its potential, I agree that there's a lot of potential in stuff like switchgrass and even native mixed prairie grasses that you hear a lot about being very productive. But the question that I have about them is that how much energy is going to go into harvesting and transporting these things and getting them to ethanol plants? And that's not a question I know the answer to, but when I see in my area hay production, and I see that all the energy that goes into bundling it up, moving it around, like one little truck, like a big truck carries a pretty small amount of hay or straw. I wonder about how viable switchgrass is ever going to be. And I think the readers, you know, short answer, yes. I think that simple conservation probably trumps biofuel down the road.
And I just want to say at this moment that Jake Caldwell, in your report for Center for American Progress, you do suggest that biofuel production plants be located widely dispersed so as to avoid having to transport things far. So that is a solution that you've offered. I want to go now to Roger in Hercules. Roger, thanks so much for joining us this morning on Sunday Salon.
Yeah, thanks a lot for taking my call. What is fossil fuel and ethanol CO2 footprint in manufacturing and burning ethanol? We know we use fossil fuel to farm and produce ethanol. Is the total CO2 less than for burning fossil fuel alone if we use an ethanol mixture, or how does that work?
Thanks, Roger, for that call. Let's see who can respond to that. Is there among you someone who'd like to answer that one?
Well, I'll just pipe in real quick, and I'll also let Jake take a crack at it. But
is that Tom or Jake?
This is Tom.
Tom Philpott.
But you know, Jake says, and I've read this too, that that the overall the production of even corn ethanol reduces is about 13% better at 13% less greenhouse gases emitted from corn ethanol than from gasoline production. But one thing that I think that we need to talk about in this discussion is the fact that increasing numbers of ethanol plants are switching from natural gas to coal to process the ethanol. And I think that when you add coal to the equation, you've gone off the deep end. When you're burning coal to create a green fuel, something is going wrong. And I'd like to hear Jake's comment on that.
Jake Caldwell.
Yeah, no, I absolutely agree. I mean, we've seen, I don't have precise statistics, but a lot of these new ethanol plants that are being built, as the price of natural gas has gone up, they're using coal to fire them in their processes, and that is definitely a concern of ours. I mean, that is going to affect in a significant way your capacity to reduce greenhouse gas reduction. I would just reiterate the 13% greenhouse gas emission savings for corn-based ethanol, and the statistics are available in the January 2006 issue of Science magazine, and I believe some of the work was been done out at University of California, Berkeley. But all that underscores that we can do much, much better, and we can do much better with switchgrass and prairie grasses in terms of, there's one study out of the University of Minnesota that suggests that over the course of sort of a 10-year lifetime for prairie grasses, they absorb 14 times their weight in greenhouse gas carbon reduction. So that is pretty significant. If we can move beyond corn, we're going to be in a lot better shape. I just want to respond to Tom, too, in terms of the cost question of ethanol. Certainly, with the price of corn going up, primarily because of the demand for ethanol, we won't be paying out the $5 to $6 billion a year in subsidies. So that's good news. That means more money in the pockets of others, but less money from taxpayers. So hopefully the cost of ethanol production will go down.
I would have to challenge that, Jake, because if we're going to, as I understand it from a study that came out by the Global Studies Initiative, the Global Subsidies Initiative in Switzerland, to meet Bush's goal of 35 billion gallons by 2017, it's going to take about 11 billion a year. And that's because, you know, that's basically because that's assuming that the 51 cents a gallon tax credit for mixers is going to be there. And from all indications, it's going to be there. And that's it's going to cause basically the subsidies to ethanol producers go up with scale. And that is... that's pretty crazy.
So, Tom Philpott, let's leave that comment right there. I wanted to ask a question that's been posed by a listener and one that I was eager to talk about, which is biodiesel fuels made using diesel and also recycled vegetable oils as a possible solution. Just want to talk about how sustainable is that? To what scale is that a possible solution? Either Jake Caldwell or Tom Philpott want to weigh in on that. And talk about the difference between biodiesel and ethanol.
Go ahead, Jake.
I was going to say, Tom. Huh?
I don't mind talking.
I think Isabella should weigh in on this, too, because a lot of the soy production is ramping up in Brazil, and what is the potential for Brazilian soy production, which is a major competitor to U.S. soy production, what is the potential for Brazil to be in the biodiesel market? The Europeans have set very aggressive standards for mandates, essentially, requiring biodiesel in their overall fuel mix. So the whole question of biodiesel, I believe, in the first 5 years of, from 2000 to 2005, I think biodiesel production globally has quadrupled. So it's a major issue. I think the question of biodiesel from vegetable oil or recycled oil, fast food and things like that, the major question is scale. Will that be any way able to make a drop in the bucket in terms of our consumption of biodiesel? And I think for the short term, at this stage, I think biodiesel is mostly going to be about soy and other oil seeds and less about recycled oil, unfortunately.
Isabella Kenfield, can you weigh in on biodiesel in Brazil?
I know that Brazilians are developing the biodiesel market. Most of the talk and the research and the money, I think, is going towards developing ethanol from sugarcane. But certainly, I mean, the same people who are controlling the grains, the big grains in the United States, are the same corporations controlling soy production in Brazil, Cargill, Archer Daniels, Midland. They're the same corporations. Certainly, soy production is affecting, it's expanding the agricultural frontier into the Amazon. So a lot of times, proponents of ethanol here in Brazil like to say, well, ethanol isn't going to affect the Amazon because you can't plant sugarcane in the Amazon region. The Amazon isn't conducive to planting sugarcane. But what happens is that the best lands in the south are planted to sugarcane, and then the soy moves gradually further north into the Amazon. And there's been tons of studies showing that soy production is completely contributing to deforestation and destruction of the Amazon.
And we have time to take just one more caller this hour, and that's going to be Lillian in Tulare County. Hi, Lillian. Thanks so much for joining us today on Sunday Salon.
Yes, you have a great show today. I live in the county with the highest percentage of food exports to different countries. We're the breadbasket of America in Tulare County, yet our children suffer high obesity rates and the amount of children that are getting diabetes 1 and 2 continues to rise. And the second comment I had was on the dairy industry. We are number one in the county, yet our smaller dairy farmers are being ousted out by the bigger dairy farmers that are coming in, the huge corporate farmers with 12,000 cows. And yet we have a serious, serious water shortage and higher environmental reports that have to be done, yet they seem to be able to get in, and the smaller dairies are not being able to comply. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for that call, Lillian, and we are going to need to wrap things up this hour. I have one final question for you, Isabella Kenfield. From a human rights point of view, what can Brazil do to improve the situation there as relates to ethanol production and to keep up the level of biofuels production there? Is there a solution?
Well, I think what Brazil should do is, me speaking as an American, my personal opinion is that Brazil should focus on producing ethanol for its internal market and using the land to produce ethanol and food for Brazilians, not to produce ethanol to sell to the United States to generate capital to buy food in supermarkets, like the kind of industrialized food system that Tom was talking about. Basically, it's this question of using the land for export or using the land to prioritize Brazilians. So what Brazilians, I think I hear a lot of people saying, is that Brazil really should adopt a politic of food production and prioritizing food production for Brazilians. So that would ensure, at the very least, food, right?
Isabella Kenfield is a freelance American journalist based in Brazil, writing on the Brazilian ethanol industry and its impact on the land and workers there. Our other guests this hour on the topic of biofuels have been Jake Caldwell, Director of Policy for the Energy Opportunity Program in the National Security Department at the Center for American Progress, and Tom Philpott, farmer from North Carolina, also writes for Grist.org and did do a special series on the topic of biofuels in December for Grist. Links to all of their writings, etc., can be found on our website at SundaySalon.org. Want to thank you all for joining us this hour.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And you are listening to Sunday Salon. Coming up next hour across the country next Saturday, thousands of people will take part in Step It Up 2007, a national day of climate action. We'll talk with organizers and participants, some of whom will have a little